And thank you, John, for reading this passage of Scripture to us. Jesus said, I am the light of the world, and whoever follows me will not walk in darkness, but have the light of life. Now, I want this evening to examine the impact that the light had on the ancient world in the first 25 years of the Christian era. And when I first read this passage as a skeptical teenager, I found it puzzling and provoking. And I want to explain some of the issues that I had to wrestle with. Firstly, did Jesus actually say this? It's not recorded in the other three Gospels, in Matthew, Mark, or Luke, which were all written before John, seemingly. However, I discovered in Matthew's Gospel, his account of the Sermon on the Mount, that Jesus said something very close to it. He records Jesus as saying to his followers, you are the light of the world, and let your light so shine before mankind that they see your good works and give glory to your Father in heaven. Now, Christ's disciples would only be lights to the world to the extent that they modelled his behaviour and did the things that he commanded them to do. So Matthew's account is entirely consistent with John's, though expressed rather differently. In both passages, the character of Christ shines as a bright light, revealing the fatherhood of God, who sent him into the world. And if you knew me, said Jesus, verse 19 of the passage John has just read to us, you would know my Father also. So Jesus uniquely reveals the character of God the Father. Now, I had great difficulty trying to imagine anyone saying, I'm the light of the world. But if Jesus didn't say it, then John, or whoever wrote his gospel, must have invented it. But either way, it was said by someone about Jesus in the first century, nearly 2,000 years ago. And the remarkable thing is that it was deemed credible at that time. And more than that, we can look back 2,000 years later and ask, is there anyone else in the entire history of the world better qualified who could meaningfully say, I'm the light of the world? Just imagine anyone today making that claim in public. Would anyone believe them? Can you imagine any figure of history saying it? Any political figure? Boris Johnson? Mahatma Gandhi? Some religious figure? The Pope? Muhammad? You see, it's one thing to say that a person is an inspiration and a luminary in their field, but quite another to say that he's the light of the world. It seems impossible to imagine. It would merely be evidence that he's barking mad, and within a generation his madness would be long forgotten. Yet when John wrote his gospel, it was widely believed that Jesus said it of himself, and it was deemed credible then, and today it remains credible. Did anyone know 2,000 years ago how Christ would impact the world and that his claim would so dramatically stand the test of time? Now, to set the context of this claim, I want to talk about history for a while. Now, I know history isn't everyone's enthusiastic subject, but just hang in. I wanted to give you a few basics on which to try and make sense of the whole of the story. Try and keep in mind, as I'm talking about various dates, that the evidence now strongly indicates, and I don't think anyone strongly disputes it, that Jesus was crucified in 33 AD. There has recently been a very carefully researched study of this subject, and I think the points in that book have largely been conceded. Yet from the historical record outside the New Testament, very little is known about Christ or his followers over the next 25 years. And that troubled me. Virtually all we know about that first generation of Christians is recorded in the New Testament, which is not a book, of course, it's a collection of 22 different historical Christian documents, diverse pieces of literature, including biographies, histories, and letters. So why this historical silence from the secular historians of the day? Well, one of the key reasons that he's initially hidden from view is that the first Christians were all Jews. And they were known as Jews. They met in the synagogues. They believed their long-awaited Messiah had come. And for the next 10 years, his disciples were entirely consumed in proclaiming the Jewish Messiah to other Jews. And as such, Christ was a Jew, and of interest only to Jews. And the secular world saw them as a funny little group on their own, and we don't have to get involved with the Jews. That seems to be the way they were regarded. It was about 10 years on before there was a breakthrough into the pagan Gentile world. And that occurred around AD 43, 10 years later, in Antioch, which was the third largest city of the Roman Empire after Rome and Alexandria. And it was here that we're told that Christ's followers were first identified as Christians. Why? Because these people weren't Jews. They hadn't been Jews. They weren't going to become Jews. And remarkably, this breakthrough into the Greek world was brought about by Christians from the Greek cultures of Cyprus and Cyrene in North Africa. It's these little details when you're reading Luke that are so fascinating. Don't skip over them. Ask questions. Why does he give us that information? So come with me now to Paul's famous letter to the Christians in Rome. It's undisputed that this is his letter, called Romans, written by Paul, and it's come down to us intact. We're very confident about the text of this letter, thought to have been written around 58 AD, might have been 57 AD, could have been 59. Any of these dates, you can shift. It is quite complicated dating things from those days because they didn't have our dating system. That was invented sort of 500 years later and didn't do it altogether accurately because Jesus probably wasn't born in 0 BC, in the year 0, etc. So any of these dates, you know, we can't be 100% certain, but most of them are fairly precise. So Romans was written about 58 AD. And the letter begins with a formal introduction. I hope some of you are quite familiar with it. But it doesn't get underway until verse 8. And it's as though Paul has been bursting to say this. He's done the sort of formal introduction, and then he says, first of all, verse 8, I want to thank God that your faith is proclaimed in all the world. What does he mean? He doesn't say, the faith is proclaimed in all the world, or my faith is proclaimed in all the world. He could have said that. He'd traveled around extensively. But he says to the Romans, your faith is proclaimed in all the world within that first 25 years after Christ's death. So it's generally believed that this statement was just flattery. The Romans were jolly nice chaps. They were awfully good Christians. Their reputation had gone before them, and everyone knew about them. But doesn't it sound as though he's saying something else here? I'm sure he is. So now come with me to the last chapter of Romans. If you've got it in front of you, do look it up, because it is fascinating. It's one of those chapters that you're likely to skip over and not look at, because it's all full of incidentals and people we don't know about, and there's a whole lot of names. And you might think, well, this isn't terribly theological or doesn't tell us much about God. It does tell us a lot about Paul and the world he was working in. He finishes his letter with a long list of personal greetings. Paul states clearly that he's never been to Rome, and yet he names nearly 30 people in Rome whom he knows, and knows well, and is deeply indebted to. Two, he said, have risked their lives for him. One had been a mother to him. Two had been in prison with him. Another was a dear friend who worked very hard. Where did he meet these people? Well, it wasn't in Rome, because Paul had never been there. And wherever he had met them, why is it that they're now all in Rome? So this is a piece of detective work. We need to ask questions of the text. And I think one of the great joys of studying the Bible is that you keep finding answers and discovering the whole way along the line. And some of this has only really dawned on me, some of the connections here in the last few years. At the head of these people that he greets, the head of the list, he names a Jew called Aquila and his wife Priscilla. They were tent makers, so we're told elsewhere. And they're mentioned five times in the New Testament. And Paul tells us, Luke tells us, that Paul first met them in Corinth in AD 50. He doesn't name the date, but it's fairly clear that if it wasn't 50, it might have been 51. Because we know about Gallio, who is mentioned, that an inscription was discovered. So Gallio was the proconsul of the region in AD 52. Gallio is quite an important guy. He was the brother of Seneca, who was a big man at the center of the Roman Empire, tended to write the emperor's speeches and that sort of thing. So Gallio is an important figure, and he was. We know from this inscription that was found that he was proconsul in 52 AD. So if Paul had met them, he says that he'd been there for 18 months before he got into trouble and was hauled before the authorities. So it all fits in with these dates very nicely. And Luke records that Aquila and Priscilla had recently been expelled from Rome by the Emperor Claudius, who ordered all the Jews to leave Rome. Now, that's a fascinating little historical detail that's just slipped into the script. And you read things like that, you hold on, what's going on here? Now, the Roman historian Suetonius, writing many years later, confirms that this happened and that the emperor's edict was because of constant riots among the Jews instigated by someone called Crestus. And this is generally acknowledged to be a misspelling or perhaps a Latinized version of the name of Christ. And another ancient writer tells us that this exodus of the Jews from Rome took place in the 9th year of Claudius's reign, which that would bring us to 49 AD, which fits entirely with what the New Testament tells us. A couple of years later, after Paul has escaped from the wrath of Gallio, Paul travelled with Priscilla and Aquila to Ephesus, and he left them there, where they led a house church meeting in their home. And there they met a leading Jewish Christian from Alexandria in North Africa, in Egypt, where we know there was a large Jewish community. His name was Apollos, and his name occurs again, mentioned by Paul in one of his letters. But they trained Apollos up and then sent him on to Corinth. So we've got good historical grounds for saying that within 20 years, all four of the major cities of the empire were being impacted by the gospel: Rome, Alexandria, Antioch, and Ephesus. They were the big four. And the next year, AD 54, Emperor Claudius died, and his edict expelling them from Rome died with him, enabling the Jews then to return home. So that when Paul writes to the Roman Christians in AD 57, these people whom he has met in all these other places have now returned home, including Priscilla and Aquila. And Paul says he's longing to see them again, and he hopes to visit them on his way to Spain. That's all in the last two chapters of Romans. So the Jesus movement was strong in Rome in AD 49 and causing so much disturbance that the Jews, among the Jews, that Claudius was forced to take this drastic action and expel them from Rome. Now, it's thought that something like 10% of the population of Rome would have been Jews. There were huge numbers of Jews in Rome and in Alexandria. So this would have been a major people movement. We don't know the population of Rome at that time. All these sort of figures are intelligent guesswork. But we're talking about an awful lot of people sent on the move by Claudius, enabling the Christian Jews from Rome to spread their faith, as Paul put it, all over the world. And Priscilla and Aquila, who clearly played their part in Corinth and Ephesus, were an important, a brilliant example of this. There are other key factors working for the spread of Christianity. One of them was the Pax Romana, the fact that all the nations embraced by the Roman Empire were living at peace with one another and one could cross borders and not be harassed. And then there were the Roman roads, which were an extraordinary development in the ancient world, meaning that people could actually travel and get information around quickly. But then, of course, in the Mediterranean, they travelled across the sea and there was colossal commercial traffic going on the whole time around the towns on the edge of the Mediterranean, such as Alexandria and Antioch, to name but a couple. Well, I'm nearly done with the history lesson, but hang on for a moment. In AD 49, while all this was going on in Rome, 1,000 miles away and quite unrelated to the situation in Rome, Paul himself was caught up in a riot in Thessalonica. And Luke, the physician, was a meticulous historian. Medical students take note of this. Getting the story right is a very important part of medicine. And Luke obviously had great attention to detail in the things he recorded. Well, he records in Acts 17 that a mob shouted before the city officials in Thessalonica, "These men who have caused trouble all over the world have now come here. And they're defying Caesar's decrees, saying there's another king, one called Jesus." So here's someone else saying that Christianity had spread all over the world, except in this report, it had already happened prior to AD 49. 9 years later, around 58 AD, at the end of our 25-year period that we're looking at, Paul was hauled up before the governor Festus in Caesarea. And we now have a lawyer called Tertullus recorded as saying, "We found this man to be a troublemaker, stirring up riots among the Jews all over the world. He's a ringleader of the Nazarene sect." So even then, Paul wasn't identified as being a Christian, but as a member of a Jewish sect. So within 25 years of Christ's crucifixion, the Jesus movement was spreading like wildfire across the ancient world, largely among the Jews. And it's in this context that John wrote that Jesus claimed to be the light of the world and was clearly making a dazzling impact. So we come back to our text. What does it mean? And I want now to apply Christ's teaching and his character and his behaviour and his claims to the world around him. The Roman Empire was a dark world. Its cruelty was breathtaking. Instead of watching television and football, the major public entertainment of the people were the games, and the games were barbaric. Not only did gladiators fight to the death, for the amusement of the crowd, but prisoners were fed to the lions or publicly crucified in the arena. The Emperor Nero apparently had a predilection for watching dwarfs, that's really tiny people, fighting women to death. It was a refined taste, no doubt, in Roman times. He blamed the Christians for the fire of Rome, and soaking them in oil had them set fire to in his gardens as a nighttime spectacle. Earlier, the Emperor Tiberius was appallingly debauched at his luxurious palace in Capri. His garden was called the Old Goat's Garden because it was there that he sexually abused small boys and provided prostitutes for his guests while he enjoyed watching them copulate. They set a high example, these emperors, of how to live your life. Even emperors commonly murdered their wives, their mothers, and of course their rivals, with impunity. There was no police force or security forces, and apart from the imperial guard in Rome to protect the emperor, the soldiers were kept miles away at the frontiers of the empire. So crime, violence, murder, tyranny, and rioting were rife and unrestrained. This was a male-dominated world, where in general women were uneducated and largely confined to domestic duties. Some 25% of the population were slaves, many of them sex slaves. Children commonly died in infancy, and unwanted babies were exposed to the elements and left on rubbish dumps. Some 50% of children died before the age of 10, giving an average expectation of life of about 25 years, although those who survived to being adults would have lived to a reasonable old age. The art which has survived describes the sexual mores of the Roman society. The erect penis, if I may use such a word in these august surroundings, was seen as a good luck charm. It's found frequently in homes. They would have a little carved penis on the wall, in the streets, celebrated in paintings, which you can see in Pompeii if you visit that fascinating town. They were made into oil lamps to go on the table, so you could have a nice little erect penis on the table with an oil flame. And even, and this is my favourite one, it made into a wind chime with little bells hanging down from it to hang in the garden. Paedophilia was common. There were no hospitals, no emergency services. And as for religion, they were deeply superstitious and worshipped a pantheon of invented gods. They even worshipped deceased emperors. And every home would have a shrine to the god of their preference. In Ephesus, for instance, they worshipped Diana, the huntress, and had a major industry there making little silver goddesses for domestic shrines. Read about that in Acts 19. In Pompeii, they had a major temple to the god Apollo and another to the Egyptian god Isis. And I won't begin to tell you the story of Isis. Fortunately, it's a myth. Other popular gods were Mithras from Persia and Bacchus, the god of wine. And all these religions were tolerated and encouraged. These gods needed to be appeased by regular sacrifices being made to them, because you had to keep on the right side of the gods, ignore them at your peril. And sexual immorality was a common feature of their religious feasts and festivals. Even Judaism was tolerated. The only religion that was not tolerated in the Roman Empire was Christianity. contrary to the decrees of Caesar, Jesus was proclaimed as the King of Kings, as the Lord of Lords, the name above every name, before whom every knee should bow. Where Jesus was proclaimed as Lord, riots followed. And this was the culture that gradually and increasingly turned from homemade gods and superstitions and sacrifices and sexual immorality, from violence and lawlessness to honesty and compassion and neighbour love, embracing King Jesus. Why? Because they saw him as a great light shining in the darkness, exposing the wickedness, while his death on the cross was seen as the sacrifice once for all to bring them peace with God. Consider slavery. Christ's golden rule is that in everything you do, you should treat other people as you'd wish to be treated yourself. That's in Matthew 7, verse 12. Now, slavery couldn't be suddenly overthrown. It was a major structural part of the economy. 25% of the population depended on it for housing, for provision, security, and employment. Christ's golden rule, however, fundamentally undermined it. And with it came a specific injunction that Christians should not be involved in the slave trade. 1 Timothy 1:10 for that reference, if you're jotting these things down. And Paul wrote there that the law of God is for lawbreakers, for the sinful, for those who kill their fathers and mothers, for adulterers and perverts, for slave traders and liars and perjurers, and for whatever else is contrary to the doctrine that conforms to the gospel. And elsewhere he wrote, "For you were once darkness, and now you are light in the Lord. So live as children of light. Have nothing to do with the deeds of darkness, but rather expose them. For it is light that makes everything visible." And that's all in Paul's letter to the Ephesians, chapter 5. These were brave things for Paul to write from in prison in Rome, awaiting trial before the emperor Nero, who had murdered his mother and his brother. It's hardly surprising they chopped Paul's head off. In the Ephesian letter, Paul wrote about those who owned slaves and how they should treat them with respect and fear. "Do not threaten them," he wrote, "for he who is their master and yours is in heaven, and there's no favoritism with him." Christians were called to love their slaves because God loved them. And they weren't just called to love their neighbours and their household slaves and servants, but to love their enemies. And Jesus was asked, "Who is my neighbour?" He told the story of the Good Samaritan, who put his life and his money on the line to care for an enemy, a man who would have hated him as being a Samaritan. So Christ called them and us to pursue truth and integrity, care and compassion, to help the vulnerable, to practice hospitality, to visit the prisoners, to honour the little children, and treat them as though they were representatives of God himself. "Whoever welcomes a little child," said Jesus, "in my name, welcomes me." Small children are a sacred trust. And the early Christians visited the prisoners, supported the weak. They were faithful to their marriage partners. They rescued babies from the rubbish dumps. They learned to turn the other cheek. They were peacemakers looking for reconciliation. And they were called to wash one another's feet. That's a slave's job. And the Christian answer to slavery was to become a slave to the best slave master the world has ever seen, to be a slave for Jesus, and to humbly serve the world. So the teaching of Christ shone like a very bright light onto the iniquities of the ancient world. But nothing's changed. People are still capable of great evil. And so we too are called to let our light shine before others so that they might give honour to our Father in heaven. And what was the prayer they prayed? It's very short. It went like this. Our Father in heaven, may your name be honoured, your kingdom come, your will be done on earth as in heaven. Well, that's the first half of the prayer. And they should be the major petitions of all our prayers, to be utterly caught up and consumed by the idea of God's kingly rule in our lives. And what did they pray for themselves? Four basics. Give us each day enough bread to live by. Forgive us our sins by the same measure that we manage to forgive others. Keep us from temptation. Don't let us go near it. But deliver us from evil. End of message. That's all we need to pray about. And that's what the Christians were called to live for. And that's what Jesus taught them to pray for. Not, oh Lord, give me loads of friends. Surround me with comforts. Give me health and worldly success. Make me famous. And let me have enough money to travel the world and see everything there is to see. Jesus turned the world's values upside down. And if we bow before him and acknowledge him as our Lord, he'll forgive us all our past sins and wickedness, provided we turn from them. And he'll turn our world upside down spiritually. Don't think for a moment that he is concerned to bring us comfort. God doesn't want to be your cushion. He wants you to take up your cross and be his disciple, modelling his style of life and his values. And don't believe for a moment the public lie that there is such a thing as British values, much talked about in the media. If it wasn't for Christ, we would have the moral values of the Roman Empire, with its cruelty and its male dominance and its sexual immorality and its culling of unwanted babies and its slavery and corruption and everything else. Why, the Harvey Weinsteins of this world would have been very comfortable in the Roman Empire. Model citizens, bullies, arrogance, self-serving and promiscuous. It's only because of Christ that the world was changed. And it can happen again, desperately needs to happen again. But God wants the light of Christ to flood into our lives, to the darkest corners of our souls, that we might bring his light and his forgiveness and his love and compassion to other people. Not that they'll thank us for it, but they will give glory to our Father in heaven, who makes God known.